nanohub.org. You can follow along with this presentation using printed slides from the NanoHub. Visit www.nanohub.org and download the PDF file containing the slides for this presentation. Enjoy the show.
Okay, so what I handed out to you today, it's like this set of equations that we have been talking about. And this is the general set that you could use to calculate current versus voltage in any of these devices. And the basic input being always there's this Hamiltonian, and then there's the connection to the contact, which is described by sigma 1 and sigma 2. And what you have discussed so far does not include this third thing here called the sigma S. You'll see I've added a new thing into this. And the significance of this, and what happens is the equations get modified a little bit, and there's some issues involved, which is what I'll try to explain today. And that would then more or less give you the complete set of equations, at least as far as elastic transport goes, which means as long as electrons go from here to here without actually exchanging energy with the surroundings. Now, the more general ones, equations, that's something we'll discuss later after spring break, which you need to understand dissipation inside the device and things like that. That we'll get into later. But this itself, you see, you can use for a wide variety of small-scale devices as it stands. And, yeah, so that's what I want to talk about. Now, just to remind you what we have done in the last few lectures is you start from Schrodinger equation, and when you connect it to the contacts, you pick up these two terms. And as I said, that's like the source term, and this is like the source resistance. I mean, if you think of this as an LC circuit, that's the source resistance kind of thing. That's the source term. Okay? And as I explained, in all these devices, one of the subtle issues is that when you have multiple sources, you cannot add wave functions. You have to add the psi-psi dagger. And that's what this Gn is. That's what you call the correlation function. It's 2 pi times psi-psi dagger. And it's a matrix, just like everything else. H, sigma, these are all matrices. What is the size of the matrix? Well, that depends on the number of grid points in your device. And the basic equations, as I said, these are perfectly general. You can use for a wide variety of devices, no matter how complicated. The details of how you get H and sigma, that might get more complicated depending on the nature of the device. But once you have H and sigma, this is it. You see? And the only practical issue you have to worry about when you get to big devices would be the size of the matrices involved, what you can handle conveniently and so on. That's a practical issue one may have to worry about. But conceptually, this is it. And one of the things I'll get into next, possibly next lecture, is just that in general how you get the sigmas and the H's. Because what I did was, I took a relatively simple example of a 1D wire and showed you how you could start from the full Schrodinger equation for the long thing, eliminate the contacts, and pick up terms like this. And then you saw that you could write the sigma as minus T e to the power IKA. In general, it's more complicated than that. But you can still always find a sigma to describe the connection to the contact. And that general approach, that's what I'll try to explain next day, and that we haven't talked about so far. Okay. Now, you'll notice then, yeah, so we started from here, got an expression for Gn, that's a psi-psi dagger, and here we introduced another quantity called sigma n, and what that tells you is the strength of the input. So what is this? It's 2 pi times SS dagger. So we defined our Gn as something like 2 pi psi psi dagger, and the sigma n as 2 pi times SS dagger. So this is the strength of the source. That's like the electron density or correlation function. And what we showed was Gn is related to the strength of the source through this.
Okay.
Now, this is where one of the results that I pulled in that we discussed is that in general, the strength of the source associated with a particular contact. So supposing I'm writing the strength of the source from the jth contact, then it's like SJS J dagger. And this is proportional to gamma J, where gamma is this imaginary part of sigma, that's the connection to the contact, times Fj. So the strength of the source, you can expect would be proportional to the Fermi function of that contact, because that tells you whether electrons are coming in or not. And it's also proportional to that coupling, to that contact. Coupling meaning how easily, remember, what gamma tells you is how easily an electron goes out of into that contact. And the thing is, if it goes out easily, the strength of the source coming in is also bigger accordingly. Okay? So based on that, we had this equation. And last couple of days, or last day, what we discussed is the equation for the current operator. That is, if you wanted to, and this was there are subtle physical issues involved that we discussed, that when you actually evaluate this current operator, this is really zero overall. It is just that you can associate different terms with different terminals. And so if you take sigma I and sigma in I, that part will tell you the current at terminal I. And overall sigma is, of course, the sum of the different sigma I's. Similarly, all this total input is the sum of the different I's. But each one of them will give you the current at that particular terminal. And the overall current at all the terminals will add up to zero, as you might expect, because of Kirchhoff's law overall. So this we discussed before. And when you do that, if you remember, we take the trace. And if you take the trace, the first term drops out. And you get the second, last two terms. And the kind of expression we had for current was something like this. Things of this sort. So it's it's two terms. This is the strength of the input, what's coming in from contact I times the density of states. That tells you how much is coming in from that contact. And this is what's going out into the contact. It's the electron density times the rate at which it goes out. And the difference is the net current. This we discussed. Now, although in general, I've always kind of drawn this with two contacts, the point is you could have as many contacts as you want, really. So if you had, say, three or four contacts, for example, all it means is you'd have a sigma 1, sigma 2, a sigma 3, sigma 4, all of them. And this sigma, of course, would be the sum of all four of them in that case. So whatever that is. Similarly, when it comes to the input, all these different things, sigma in 1 would be gamma 1 times F1, sigma in 2 would be gamma 2 times F2, etc. So you just have four of them. That's it. So overall, you can use this same set of equations to deal with a device with, say, four terminals. So mu 1, mu 2, and if you had two more terminals here, say mu 3 and mu 4. So as long as you're given the electrochemical potentials, you can always write down the Fermi function at those contacts and calculate the currents at each one of them. Whatever it is. Now, what is a little more subtle that requires more thinking is what would you do if these two terminals are actually just floating? Floating meaning, like a voltage probe. Often you do four probe measurements. So in a four probe measurement, you run your current between these, let's say, and then you leave these two floating. So the problem then is that you have mu 1 and mu 2, but then no one quite told you what mu 3 and mu 4 is. You don't know till you measure. So how would you handle that? Because till you know mu 3 and mu 4, the problem is you can't quite use these equations because you don't know what F to use there. What's the exact one to use for those terminals? And that would be the thing you'd run into. And this is where the basic trick you use is what we had discussed earlier in the context of semi-classical transport, like a few weeks back. And the idea is something like this, that if you have, say, four terminals, then you could make a sort of matrix that relates your currents at your four terminals to the Fermi functions at those four terminals. Or, as we have discussed in the context of semi-classical transport, you know, for low bias, instead of Fs, you could work directly in terms of mu's, because F would be like del F, del E times mu. You just use the mu 1, mu 2, etc. But in this context, let me just write F1s, F2, F3, F4. And in that semi-classical discussion, we said that there's an incoming flux called plus and the outgoing flux minus. And these are, of course, the incoming fluxes, because what the contacts determine is what comes in. It has really no control over what comes out. So this would be like all those plus, what we had earlier written as pluses. But here I have, when I write F, that's the F in the contact. What it really determines is what's coming into the devices. And the point is that the equations that we have discussed would allow you, I claim, to write down this matrix. You see, in the context of semi-classical transport, I said, well, these matrices you try to write down intuitively, or try to think of a classical reasoning, that if an electron came in here, what fraction would go out there? But now you could actually calculate it straight from Schrodinger equation. I mean, Schrodinger equation meaning these equations. How? Okay. The way you do it is, supposing I want this column. The way I would do it is put F1 plus equal to 1 and put all the rest equal to 0. So let us say we have electrons only coming in from 1, nothing coming in from 2, 3, or 4. And I use these equations to look at what is the current at each of the four terminals. Right? So I'll just use this equations. You know, we had an expression for I that's in your handout. I guess I didn't write the actual expression for I. Oh, it's up there. Yeah. So we have the expression for I. So you just calculate, you know, go through. You can calculate these four currents and you can put them in. And that would then give you the first column. So what that tells you is that in this device, if I put a voltage here, that's this is like 1, F1 is 1, this is like 0, this is also 0. As I said, in the real problem, these things float to some potential. I have no control. But for the moment, let's assume these are also grounded. So what that means is some current flows out. And whatever current flows out, I can calculate, and that's what will go in here. Done. So what do I do if I want the second column? Now apply the voltage to 2. See what happens. So you calculate, and then you have the second column, and the third column, and the fourth column. So given F1, F2, F3, F4, you can easily figure out what these currents would be. Now in our real problem, the thing is, we are given these two, but we are not given these two. So I'm not being able to use the equations directly. But what we are given is these two. We are told that these are equal to 0. Why is that? Because, you see, those terminals are floating. That's the voltage probe. So what I can do is solve this equation down here to express this, to put this equal to 0 so that I can express these two in terms of those two. And then I can go back. That's basically it. So all I'm saying is, here you have a set of algebraic equations. Given any four, you can figure out the other four. Now, if it was this four, then algebra is very straightforward. If it happens to be these two and these two, It's a little more algebra, that's all. But in principle, you have all the information there. Right? And this is the method that, I guess, Boutiquer introduced with his famous paper in 1986 for handling multi-terminal devices, in a way. And most people who use this, of course, do not calculate these coefficients from these equations, like we discussed. They calculate it by actually going to Schrodinger equation and having incident waves and calculating reflections, transmissions, etc. And what we have done is, what I tried to do is, kind of formalize that process so that once you have gone through this, you don't have to keep solving for every new problem setting up Schrodinger equation all over again. You see? But a lot of, most people who use this, again, they go to Schrodinger equation, calculate all the transmission coefficients, that is, if an electron comes in here, what fraction goes out there, etc., and thereby try to fill up that matrix, and then go on from there. That's what's usually done. And what we did here would be equivalent, basically. Equivalent, and the thing is, now it's formal, so once you understand this, it's like after you have written H's and sigmas, you don't really have to think. The rest of it is just flows, follows. Okay. Now, one of the other insights that Boutiquer had in this context, that's also widely used, is the following. You see, last day I tried to explain why just this theory isn't quite enough for a lot of devices, because you have to include phase breaking. The point I tried to make is that if you had a device with one scatterer, something like this, and you look at the current that would flow at different energies. So supposing we have one scatterer, and we consider the case where you're injecting electrons from here, F1 is equal to 1, and this is empty, F2 equals 0. So you're just trying to figure out how much current would flow at a given energy. So you can do the calculation at different energies. I mean, same equations, of course, depending on what energy you get, you'll get different answers. Because the energy is the energy of the incoming electron. If it happens to propagate easily through the wire, you'd get a lot of current. If not, you'd get less. And the thing is, what you'd find then is something like this, that as you get higher in energy, you get scattered less by that impurity, by that defect, and you actually transmit a little more. That makes sense. If there was no scatterer, you might have found something like this. And you get like a ballistic case, like any electron that comes in goes transmits straight through. That would be the thing. Now, the thing is, when you put two of them, then the point I was trying to make is, again, if you use this theory that we have discussed, you'd end up with a bunch of peaks like that because of this quantum interference. This interference, which is a property of waves, that Athes tries to explain, that just when this distance happens to be exactly a quarter of a wavelength, that's when the reflections cancel out and you get enormous amount of transmission, which I said you cannot really understand from any particle model, because particles will never go better through two scatterers than through one, no matter what. Right? Okay. So, but this is something that under special conditions with small devices, small well-designed devices, you see that, but rarely. Most often, of course, you don't see that. You have something with one scatterer and something with two scatterers, well, you just get a little less transmission. Just like what Ohm's law says, you make it longer, resistance should go up. For the same voltage, you should get less current. And the reason is, you just get scatter, you know, longer you make it, more scatterers you have, less the electrons can get through. In fact, in the semi-classical picture, if you remember, we found that the transmission was something like a mean free path divided by mean free path plus length. So the long, if you have impurities that are uniformly distributed in your channel, you'd find that it actually goes down with length. Once the length is long enough, you can drop this, and that's how you get Ohm's law. Okay. So the problem is, what people recognized is that in order to handle devices, especially at room temperature, it is important to include this, what are called phase breaking processes. And what you mean by phase breaking is, As I mentioned, that in all solids, usually it's not like a rigid solid that electrons just go through and just see some static potential. There's always this jiggling going on. So it is like a wave trying to go through a very stormy atmosphere. So it's like, you know, you have, if you had tried to do radar through a thunderstorm, it's almost like that, you see, that you have waves coming in, but then you have this, all the scattering going on in here. And that aspect needs to be included in all real devices, especially at room temperature, and actually even at low temperatures. Now, one method that Boutiquer introduced in this context, he said, well, you know, you see, putting in this phase-breaking processes, that's a relatively difficult thing in general, right? And what I'll be describing to you today is one way of doing it, actually, which is through this sigma S, this extra sigma that I'll explain in a minute. But it is closely related to an idea that Boutiquer had. You see, what he said was, as he was dealing with these voltage probes, you know, dealing with multi-terminal things, he said that, well, you see, one of the things these voltage probes are doing is also they're introducing phase breaking. In the sense that, you see, when you leave a probe here floating like this, what happens is the electron goes out there and then is re-injected back again. Because it's floating, it can't get out. So it kind of develops a potential there and then comes back again. So the effect of this probe is to take an electron out and put it back with its phase randomized. Because whatever comes in, of course, you are assuming always has its phase random. We only superpose psi-psi daggers from different terminals. So the very process of putting a floating probe in a way, you see, introduces phase breaking. And so he said that, well, of course, if you really have a voltage probe, we know how to handle it. But even if you don't have one, you could put in a few fictitious ones to include some phase breaking. You see, and that's again one thing that often people do. You see, because it's so easy to do in the sense that you don't need anything new. Just act like there is a voltage probe there and adjust its scattering. If you want to, a little extra phase breaking, make the scattering a little bigger. If you want less, make it a little weaker, right? And that will mean the problem with this is, firstly, of course, you can only do it in a localized way. You can't quite do it in a distributed way. And secondly, you're not only breaking phase, but you're also breaking the momentum in a way. That is, this also introduces extra resistance. Why? Because, you see, here's an electron going along, and when you introduce this, it goes out, but then when it comes back in, it goes both ways. And so, in effect, you have kind of randomized momentum as well, and there'll be a little extra resistance. And if you want to have it come back in the same way, you have to do some more special tricks to do that. Right? And there are some ways of, you know, getting around them and trying to get pure phase breaking also, etc. Okay. So in the literature on this small conductor, so it's generally referred to as this mesoscopic physics, often people introduce phase breaking like this. Because then again, the advantage is, you know, you don't really have to do anything new. Pretend like there's a voltage probe. Okay? Now, what I have usually preferred, and that's what, I guess, the sigma S that I was talking about, it also is kind of similar in spirit, in the sense that it's like the sigma 1, sigma 2, and then this phase-breaking part, that's the sigma S. It is like another contact in a way. Right? So there's a sigma S, just like the rest. These equations remain much the same, in the sense this sigma is now sigma 1 plus sigma 2 plus sigma S. The sigma N, same thing. But the difference is that when you get to one of these, when you get to the sigma in S, it is not equal to gamma S times Fs. So while for the real contacts, it is just gamma times F, for the scattering one, it's not equal to that. Why is that? Well, because, you see, real contacts, what they do is, when an electron goes out, it gets re-injected according to the Fermi function in that contact. Contacts are always held in equilibrium according to some Fermi function. On the other hand, the scattering process is really not quite like that at all. There is really no Fermi function inside. That is, once you get inside this device, things are not distributed according to Fermi function necessarily. You're out of equilibrium. It could be distributed in different ways. It doesn't have to be a Fermi function. So to kind of put in a Fermi function, that's really not quite right. And so the general theory, and these are, so these equations that we are talking about, this is what's called this NEGF equations. NEGF stands for non-equilibrium Green functions. So Green function, you realize, that's G. And this Gn, that's the non-equilibrium Green function. It tells you this electron density under non-equilibrium conditions. That is, if it was equilibrium, then you wouldn't need a separate equation for this. You could have just taken density of states and multiplied by the Fermi function. You wouldn't need something, a separate equation to find electron density. But this is a non-equilibrium thing, and so you need a separate equation for it. And this is what was first derived back in the 60s by Keldysh, by Karanoff and Bain. There are classic papers from the 60s which derived that equation, essentially. The one thing that is different from the 60s now is that, you see, till the 1990s, no one really worried about the contacts very much. The 2N. Because usually what happens is when you talk about resistance and current flow in large conductors, it is really determined by the scattering processes. That is, how easily an electron gets through from here to here for big devices really depends on what the scattering is inside. Which is why back in the 60s and 70s when people talked about the theory of current flow, they always worried about the scattering. It was all about the sigma s. It was not about sigma 1 and sigma 2. It is just that in the 80s when people started making measurements on ballistic conductors, real small things, that's where this becomes kind of negligible, and the important thing is this. So the importance of contacts into this whole discussion kind of suddenly became very important once people started looking at real small conductors. Otherwise, it was always just a minor detail. Of course, any experiment has contacts, and experimentalists are very aware of all that. It's just that for the purposes of working out the theory, that was a minor detail, sort of, in there, that you put in at some point, at least as far as this kind of atomistic theory is concerned. Real devices, again, you always worry about the contacts, of course. But the thing is that the whole theory of transport then, like even if you look at Boltzmann equation or these NEGF equations, like I say, it's really all about scattering, not about the contacts. Whereas nowadays, for small devices, actually, you get a much better starting point is to forget the sigma s altogether and just start from contacts. And what's also nicer about it is that the sigma 1 and sigma 2 are kind of relatively easy to talk about. The theory of sigma s gets much more complicated. You see, this whole scattering process. That is, the sigma 1 and sigma 2, for example, when I tried to explain where that sigma comes from, we started from Schrodinger equation and just eliminated certain terms and you got here. And it's an exact process. No approximations, etc. On the other hand, the sigma s, that's a approximation. That is, you have these electrons interacting with each other, they're interacting with phonons, it's a complicated many-body problem. And people have developed this what's called many-body perturbation theory. That is, they start from no interaction and treat the interaction as a perturbation. And based on that, they develop an entire expansion for this. And that's kind of what this full NEGF theory, this theory is about. It talks about how to calculate this sigma s to different degrees of approximation. Whereas for our purpose, we're not going into that. And as I said, the theory of sigma 1 and sigma 2, the two contacts, that's relatively much simpler, and we have more or less discussed it already. And for sigma s, what I'll be telling you today is a relatively very simple version of it. The nice thing about it is that this simple version itself is enough to give you a specified degree of phase breaking, so that with two scatterers, you'd actually get this instead of that, for example, depending on how much you put in. And if you put a, do not put in any phase breaking, you'll get that. On the other hand, if you put in a certain amount of phase breaking, you'll get that. So you can go continuously from one to the other. And for that, all you need is a relatively simple modification, which is what's here. You'll see. And that's what I want to explain to you. And but this basic thing, this what I'll be discussing today, that in its full general form could be used to handle all kinds of interactions up to any degree, any order, etc. And some of which we'll be doing later on after spring break when you talk about dissipative processes. We'll get into that later. Okay. Now, the basic idea here, then, is the following. So we have this device, sigma 1, sigma 2, H. Let me just draw this a little bit over here. Now, the physical picture is, then, that as the electron goes through this device, there is some amount of this random potential in here, some jiggling inside. And that potential I'll call U, which then would enter the Schrodinger equation as a U times psi. Right? As you know, in the Schrodinger equation, if you had a potential U, you'd just add it to this H. So any scatterer, something like this, would normally just have gone in there into the H. And I'm kind of writing it this way. Now, the only thing is, I'll treat it a little differently. And for this discussion, let's assume this U is a constant. It's not even varying with X. It's a constant thing all over the device, but then it's random, just varying randomly with time. But it's varying slowly enough that I don't have to worry about the fact that if it varies really fast, it would take electrons from one energy and put it into another, because then you actually have to deal with a time-varying potential. But that I'm not worrying about. So in this context, it's as if what this does is just adds a little random potential there, U psi. And the thing is, I'm going to treat this much like the source term there. You know, just as you had electrons coming in from the contact giving you a certain source, now what happens is it is as if you have an extra source term which is proportional to the psi itself. So it is as if you have so previously it was like when I wanted to write sigma n, it's the strength of the source term, 2 pi SS dagger. Now, instead of S, it is like I have got a U star, and then psi dagger. Why? Because, as I said, this is the strength of the source. Now what you have is a source term that is like U times psi. And so the strength of that is this, which you could write as some coefficient d, nothing to do with density of states, some number d times gn. So this is what then the scattering term would look like. So the scattering process you could view as if it is giving you an input term that's like proportional to the electron density itself. So it kind of looks around what's the electron density, and there's this jiggling process going on. So what happens is, as a result, some of this probability flows out and then flows back in again. And that flowing back in again is this U psi, and the strength of that would be proportional to the electron density itself. That's the thing. So that's basically the new scattering term that we included then. It is like the sigma n S, the scattering, is like dgn. So when you are solving this equation here, gn is equal to g sigma n g dagger, this sigma n contains the usual stuff due to all your contacts, but then to that you also have to add this extra term, which is DGN. There's an extra term there like that. Right? This is what's coming from the scattering thing. Now, that actually makes this equation a little harder to solve. Why? Because now you have GN here as well as there. You see? So you'd have to solve this either self-consistently or algebraically try to combine these two terms, etc. But that's what makes it a little harder. But the physical picture is just this, that previously you had all these source terms coming in from contacts, and now it is like what's inside gets scattered and then gets re-injected again. That's that process. That's that. Now, just as we are including an in-scattering due to this, the thing is that in order to for this to work, you also have to include something to the sigma. That is, you have all the sigmas due to all the contacts, but then you also have to add a term due to the scattering itself, something here. Because if you don't do that, then all you would have is stuff coming in. The thing is, there's the balance. Yes, there's things going out and coming back in. So this gives you something coming back in, but you also need to put in something here that would take it back out. Now, question is, how do I figure out what to put here? Okay. And the answer is, actually, let me just write down the answer first, and then I'll try to justify, is that it's equal to D times G. So in other words, here, instead of sigma S, I'll have a D times G inverse. Now, once again, this makes it an iterative process, because you have a G here as well as a G here. So you kind of start from some guess and iterate to the solution. Okay? Now let me explain why this one should look like DG. I justified this by saying that the input is 2 pi times the strength of the source. The strength of the source is U psi, which is like this U star times GN. And this is the quantity we are defining as D. Done. Now my point is that the same D should also appear here. And that I haven't justified to do that. And then you have the full set of equations, essentially. That's what I have here. So basically, the only difference from what we have discussed so far is that to all the in-scattering from all the real contacts, you have to also add this. And to all the sigmas from the real contacts, you also have to add that. That's the only change, really. Right? And where the D is, what is D? It's a measure of this random potential that the electrons feel. What is the units of D? Well, it's like a potential energy squared. So you'd expect something like electron volt squared. And you'll see, unit-wise, that looks right, in the sense that this is energy, whereas Green's function G is like per unit energy. It is like inverse electron volts, because G is like E inverse. So this is per electron volt. This is electron volt squared. So when I multiply them, it's again electron volt, which has the same unit as all the rest. Okay? So this D then is electron volt squared, and it has a simple physical meaning. It is this strength of the random potential in there. That's it. Okay, so let me then quickly justify why, if you have a DGN here, you also need a DG there. And the basic justification actually is from, you can see from this equation for the current. Because when you look at the current that we had written down, the expression was, I won't worry about the first term. That, as you know, when you trace it, goes away anyway. It's the second term. So this is what we had last time for the current operator. And then if you remember, we took the trace and the sigma minus sigma dagger became the gamma, and the g dagger minus g became a, etc. But this is a, And what we are now doing is we're saying that to this is the overall current operator, and each one of these, if you wanted the current at terminal I, you should use the sigma from I and the sigma in from I. So let's say we want to find the current from terminal, from the scattering terminal, conceptually. Like, what is the current that comes from the scattering part? Then you'd put a S here and a S here, and a S here and a S here. And what I argued is that this should be equal to dGm. That was my argument here. Now, what I claim is that the corresponding thing for the outgoing thing, you should put d times g. And the reason is simply this, that you see here, this gives you dgn g dagger. Now, the thing is that for the current associated with the scattering should be exactly zero. Because that really, the way you're thinking of it is, electrons go out and then come back again. It is really like Boutiquer's floating probe. Right? So, as far as the scattering terminal is concerned, whatever you do here, it should just cancel out and give you zero. Otherwise, you'll actually have unaccounted for current, because you'll have current coming out of that scattering sigma S, which isn't really there, of course. I mean, current has to come out only of all your physical terminals, not through the scattering one. So, the way I can ensure that here, you see, is if instead of sigma S also, I put d g. Because then you see this becomes d g g n, and this one becomes d g n again. And d is just a number, so it's not a matrix here in this discussion. So, this becomes g g n, that's also g g n, there's a d. So, this will cancel that, and that will cancel that. You see? So, the point I'm trying to make is, so the overall argument is that there is this in-scattering term due to the phase-breaking process, which is proportional to the electron density inside. And how do you do that? Well, in-scattering is the strength of the source term, and because of this random potential, you have a source that's like u psi. And so, the in-scattering is proportional to psi psi dagger, and that's the strength dgn. Next point is, anytime you put in an in-scattering, you also have to include a sigma, something that will take electrons out. Because overall, the process is this thing about how, you know, electrons are going out because of the gamma and coming in because of this sigma n. And if you look at the current operator, what you can see is that if this is dgn, then in order to make sure that there is no net current, you must have sigma s equals dg. So that this would, I guess, would be dgn dagger. dg dagger. So then what would happen is this would cancel that, and this would cancel that, and there would be no current. And it would be a consistent thing. Right? So this is the way one can put in phase breaking directly into these equations. And in this discussion, the d is just a number, electron volt square, which gives you a measure of this random potential. And what it does is simply takes your wave function, multiplies it by some random phase, and then puts it back again. That's what this whole math is doing. See? And the effect in the real world, of course, this phase breaking, as I said, one of the most, at low temperatures, one of the most common causes of the phase breaking is what's called electron-electron interaction. Namely, that one electron feels some potential due to all the other electrons, which you usually take into account through the Poisson equation. But what is harder to take into account is the dephasing associated with it. Namely, one electron sees a random potential around it because of all the other electrons which are moving around. And that itself kind of destroys the phase somewhat. So experimental fact is that once you go below 10 Kelvin, the mobility doesn't increase anymore. Usually the mobility more or less saturates. Why? Because they say the phonons have frozen out. So actually the lattice isn't really jiggling all that much anyway once you get down to below 10 Kelvin. So you might think that, well, once you go below 10 Kelvin, there should be no more dephasing either. But the fact is that experimental measurements that actually depend on the phase, they show that when you go down below 10 Kelvin, I mean down towards millikelvins, those effects keep getting bigger and bigger. Mobility doesn't, because mobility doesn't depend on phase. It only depends on momentum relaxation. But there are other observable things in resistance itself, things what's called weak localization, which we'll talk about later, I'll explain, which actually depends on phase-breaking processes. And those effects get much larger as you go to low temperatures. And they believe it's because, again, of this electron-electron interaction. But in this context, what I'm saying is that into this theory, if you want to put in some amount of phase-breaking, without really getting into the microscopic details of what caused it, then the quickest way is something like this. Namely, put in a D here and think of the D as the RMS value of this jiggling, of this random potential. That's always there in any device. Right? So it could be 1 millivolt square. That would be a relatively small random potential. Could be about 10 millivolt square. That would be a relatively bigger one, etc. And it requires a relatively minor modification of the equations we talked about. It just adds another term, dg. In terms of calculation, makes it a little harder because previously it was a direct process. Now you have to do it self-consistently. Right? And okay, so these then are the full set of equations that one could use to analyze, you know, all kinds of devices actually. And what I'll talk about next day is this part that I mentioned before, namely how do you in general find the sigma for a given contact? Because so far all we have discussed about is the simple 1D wire where it's minus T to the power IKA. But there's a more general thing that could be applied to any general contact. Right? But the basic equations then are like what we have here. Okay. Let me stop here today.